Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kennette Benedict, former executive director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, who discusses the Obama administration's decision not to adopt a proposed nuclear weapons no first use pledge. Author, activist, and organizer Kevin Alexander Gray, who examines the new role some young professional U.S. athletes have taken on, becoming active on the issues of racial justice. And John Harity, president of the Connecticut State Council of Machinists, who talks about his successful sponsorship of a resolution at the Machinists' recent convention, making the fight against climate change a top priority. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid the most serious refugee crisis since World War II, the United Nations spent 2 days debating their response, but made little progress in dealing with millions of new migrants. However, the UN summit on refugees and migrants was quickly overshadowed by the bombing of a large UN aid convoy in Aleppo, Syria. The U.S. blamed Russia and Syria, after which Syria's military launched a heavy bombardment on the embattled city. While the General Assembly passed a non-binding resolution on migration, it did not ask for any commitments from member states to accept any specific number of refugees. Lebanon, which currently has the highest concentration of refugees in the world, is hosting over 1 million people fleeing the Syrian civil war. Lebanese Prime Minister Tamam Salam told the UN delegates, "It is unthinkable that Lebanon alone can cope with an existential challenge of such proportion." While President Obama won praise for boosting U.S. aid commitments for refugees, Washington came under harsh criticism for its treatment of 100,000 child migrants fleeing violence in Central America, many of whom are exposed to harsh conditions in immigration detention centers. The Guardian newspaper reports nearly half of the 265 million guns in the United States are owned by 3% of American adults, so-called super owners, who own an average of 17 firearms. These owners are mostly gun collectors, firearms instructors, or competitive shooters. At the same time that gun ownership has declined among men over the last 20 years, gun ownership among women has been on the rise. Overall, the vast majority of gun owners are white, male, conservative, and live in rural areas. According to an unpublished national survey of gun ownership by researchers at Harvard and Northeastern universities, political conservatives are twice as likely to own a gun as their progressive counterparts. The peer-reviewed study, set to be published in 2017, found 400,000 guns are stolen each year, and two-thirds of the 30,000 gun-related deaths each year are suicides. While gun ownership among women has increased since the mid-1990s, women are also very supportive of gun control measures. Every Town for Gun Safety, the group founded by former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, recently launched a new public education campaign focused on increasing support for strengthening gun laws among single women. 5 years ago, Troy Davis was executed in the state of Georgia after being convicted of killing a white police officer. The case drew international attention due to the fact there was no physical evidence linking the African-American man to the murder. A vibrant grassroots movement emerged to defend Davis that included 50 members of Congress, former President Jimmy Carter, and former FBI Director William Sessions. In the days before his sentence was carried out, hundreds of college students marched on the White House, urging President Obama to stop it, but the president refused to order a federal investigation that might have led to a delay in Davis's execution. The protest laid the groundwork for the development of the Black Lives Matter movement and placed a new focus on police reform for Occupy Wall Street activists. Activist Brandon King of the Malcolm X grassroots movement remembers that the execution of Davis provoked a conversation about police violence and militarism among many Occupy activists, who later took up the cause, challenging the New York City Police Department's policy of stop and frisk, which clearly and deliberately engaged officers in racial profiling. 5 months after Davis was executed, Trayvon Martin was murdered by George Zimmerman in Florida. In the aftermath of Zimmerman's acquittal, Oakland community organizer Alicia Garza wrote the words "Black Lives Matter" on her Facebook page. Her post helped unleash the power of mass protest and direct action across the U.S., expressing the moral outrage of a new generation of civil rights activists. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Not long after President Obama took office, the world paid close attention when the new U.S. head of state made his first foreign policy speech in Prague in the Czech Republic. On April 5, 2009, he told a crowd of tens of thousands that America, as the only nation ever to use nuclear weapons, had the moral responsibility to take the initiative to reduce and eventually eliminate nuclear weapons stockpiles. But now, just months before he'll be leaving the White House, Mr. Obama has failed to fulfill his ambition to rid the world of nuclear weapons and remove the threat of nuclear annihilation. Instead, he leaves office with the U.S. poised to spend upwards of $1 trillion over the next 3 decades to modernize the nation's nuclear arsenal. Critics fear that the upgrading of America's nuclear weapons will trigger a new global nuclear arms race and is bound to be perceived as an existential threat by Russia, worsening an already bad relationship. But with an eye towards his presidential legacy, Mr. Obama initiated a discussion among his national security advisers on whether or not to adopt a nuclear no-first-use pledge, making a commitment not to use nuclear weapons unless the nation was attacked with nuclear weapons first. Since World War II, U.S. nuclear doctrine has maintained the right to use nuclear weapons whether or not other nations use them first. In the end, the president rejected adoption of the no-first-use pledge after his advisers warned that such a policy could undermine allies and embolden Russia and China. Your reporter spoke with Kennett Benedict, current senior advisor and former executive director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Here she assesses the debate on the no-first-use pledge and explains why she and many other arms control advocates support its adoption.
We are still on very high state of launch readiness. Nixon said it best, I think, when he said, "I can go back to my office and make a phone call, and in 20 minutes I can kill 70 million people with nuclear weapons." We're pretty much still on that what's called hair trigger alert. The president can command a launch of weapons, and one launch would be about 50 intercontinental ballistic missiles, for instance, with the power to kill tens of millions of people. So we are still right now in a kind of Cold War status. We really haven't changed the posture very much. We have reduced nuclear weapons. We have many fewer than we did at the height of the Cold War. We're down to about 1,000 or less, 1,500, depending on how you count, operational. But our posture is still extremely prone to miscalculation and really unnecessary risk from a launch of these weapons.
Recently, the Obama administration has had somewhat of a public discussion on adopting a different doctrine for the use of nuclear weapons, something called a pledge of no first use. Explain that to our listeners and what seems to be the final outcome of that debate in the White House, where there's been an option not to change U.S. policy on the use of nuclear weapons, meaning that the United States maintains a posture that they will and can use nuclear weapons in any given situation that threatens the security of the United States.
What was unusual was the public nature of that discussion. Usually those kinds of discussions happen behind closed doors. And it's since surfaced that, in fact, three of Obama's cabinet members, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Energy, all are said to have come out and say, no, it's not time to back away from using these first. We should not adopt a no-first-use policy, that we should continue to be able to use them even if no one else has used them first.
Kinnett, maybe you can explain a bit about the position of some in the Obama administration that keeping the nuclear option open, even if the U.S. is not attacked with nuclear weapons first, is supported by many in the administration. And your counter view that this is really a dangerous position to maintain.
Yeah, I think some of the reasoning, as I understand it, is that it will be, in a sense, destabilizing, that any change in doctrine can be viewed as destabilizing. And some believe that it will show that we are weak. Russia, especially Vladimir Putin, will view us as weak and will want to take great advantage of that. The Chinese may see it as weakening of our position. There's also some talk that those in Asia, our allies, Japan and South Korea in particular, might see this as backing away from our commitments to defend them against any invasion or problems with China. And, of course, those two countries both have the capability to make nuclear weapons. But I think that if we're really interested in providing kind of a stable relationships with all of our allies, the U.S. probably should not have begun its program of nuclear weapons modernization, which has now become formalized in a plan over 30 years to really refurbish our nuclear weapons with about $1 trillion of taxpayer money. So that was in itself destabilizing, and in response to that, actually, Russia has also embarked on a modernization program, as have the Chinese. So we've already kind of destabilized, if you will, the situation. So to talk for them to talk about a no first use as destabilizing seems a little disingenuous, I guess. But the main thing is this. The position of our nuclear forces are such that we're really in a game of chicken. You know, that old game where you kind of head towards each other at full speed and the first one who blinks, you know, kind of goes off the road and crashes. And in a way, we're in a kind of mutual game of chicken with the Russians. The problem with no first use is that if they think that we can use these weapons at will, and if they believe that we're maneuvering in some way to take advantage of a nuclear strike, Russia could quite easily engage in a preemptive strike on us. So it's not a very stable situation as it is now. And I think that's the real problem with continuing a first use, that is, we can use them anytime, because anytime anybody gets nervous, any of the countries that do have nuclear weapons with the capability to hit our populations, we really are risking our own country and our own nation when we continue to have this policy. And I think that's the risk of nuclear annihilation is really what we're talking about here. And to back away from a first-use policy would reduce that risk quite enormously.
That was Kinnett Benedict, current senior advisor and former executive director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Learn more about the debate on nuclear modernization, disarmament, and the No First Use Pledge by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In quick succession in recent weeks, the nation was jolted into remembering the ongoing and urgent issue of police violence in communities of color. On September 16th, Tulsa, Oklahoma police said that when they responded to a report of an abandoned vehicle in the middle of the road, four officers confronted a 40-year-old black man, Terrence Crusher, who, with his hands up, walked towards his vehicle. Police said that when Crusher refused to follow their commands, one officer shot him with a stun gun, and simultaneously another white officer on the scene fired one round of live ammunition, killing the father of four. That officer, Betty Jo Shelby, was later indicted on charges of first-degree manslaughter. Several days later, another police shooting in Charlotte, North Carolina, set off days of street protests that resulted in smashed windows and violence that led to another civilian-on-civilian shooting death. On September 20th, police said that while looking to serve a warrant on an unrelated person, they spotted Keith Lamont Scott, a 43-year-old black man, exit his vehicle with a gun, then got back into the car. When police ordered him out of the car, A black plainclothes officer fired 4 shots, killing Scott. Hundreds of protesters took to the streets in Charlotte, demanding release of the police video recording of the incident. However, when 2 tapes were released, there was general agreement that the recording shed little light on whether or not the shooting was justified. In response to police violence and his view of unchecked racial injustice in the U.S., San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick engaged in a silent protest by refusing to stand for the playing of the national anthem earlier this summer. In response, he's been attacked as unpatriotic, received death threats, but has also been favorably compared by some to Muhammad Ali for taking a courageous stand on the issues of social justice. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, a journalist, author, and activist living in South Carolina. Here, Gray examines the new role some young professional U.S. athletes have taken on, becoming active on the issues of racial justice.
I have a friend who teaches at Brooklyn College, and last year she asked her students, young millennials, who was Jesse Jackson. And all they knew was he said something bad about Obama. And she said this semester she asked him, even after reading Frank Barnicky's book, Trampling Out the Vintage, who was Cesar Chavez? And they didn't know. So in that, Collins' protest has led people to go back and look at what Muhammad Ali did, not just know that Muhammad Ali was great and against the war and he recently died, to go back and look at Muhammad Ali and the stand he took, and to go back and look at Tommy Smith and John Carlos and what they did in Mexico. So Colin Kaepernick has really given these young people something, an effort, a protest that reaches back into our history, that gives them something that they can do positively, be it kneeling, be it raising that fist as a first start, and to become more aware of the issues in the context of our struggle. Police killing black people isn't new. It's just being recorded. And we're in the internet age, and it's being reported across the country, across the world. And so the world is getting to know what black people have always known, what Richard Pryor joked about in the 70s. This idea even of citizens review boards, shoot-to-kill policy, even their reluctance to support Hillary Clinton because they are going back and looking at the language of the 93 crime bill and the idea of the super predator and words like wilding and predatory black males and the war on drugs and the increase in police powers with the war on drugs and where those powers were targeted, the contemporary racial profiling of people of color. I remind people that Native Americans or Natives and black people have been profiled since they profiled Africans to put them on the boat, to kidnap them to bring them over here, and profiling Native Americans to kill them to take their land. So profiling isn't new, but in the present context, the war on drugs drives it. As I mentioned in the piece that I wrote for The Progressive, whites have always viewed, or at least white supremacy, the idea of it, has always viewed black people as the enemy within. That if, in fact, there's going to be an internal protest, it will be from the people who have suffered from the most political, social, economic inequities. And that seems to be a driver, although blacks do a lot in this country to try, be it in their individual relationships or in their structural relationships with white people, to get white people to understand they are Americans and they want to be accepted by white folk. So to see these young people organizing a movement, participating where they can, taking the heat for participating, that's a good thing. The next step is to participate in the meetings, or keep organizing even after the cameras are gone, to elect people that represent their issues, to really start to understand what being a progressive and what progressivism really is.
I wonder what you make of the avalanche of criticism that San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick has received, even death threats, questioning his patriotism and the like. What does that indicate to you?
What Ali went through, no different than what Tommy Smith and John Carlos went through. Dr. King never burnt anything and never looted anything. And look what happened to him. It comes with the territory that the people that believe that you ought to stay in your place, they demand that you respect their history. They don't even read or try to understand your experience in the history of this country. This country is a land of immigrants, natives, and descendants of kidnap victims. People don't want to really want to grasp what that means. You know, black people have built this country. Enslavement was the foundation of modern capitalism, yet and still, folk want to paint this idea that black people are the most violent of violent in American society, even given that since World War II, this country has been responsible for over 30 million deaths, and it's surely not black people that are pressing the button or making the decisions that send people off to war, that send drones to kill people, that give the command to drop nuclear weapons. The culture of white supremacy and empire is a violent culture and a violent belief system, and black people, like everybody else, are victims of that.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray, a journalist and organizer with the Harriet Tubman Freedom House Project in South Carolina. Gray is co-editor of the book Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. For more perspectives on the issues of police violence, racial division, and the activism of U.S. athletes, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The AFL-CIO recently announced its support for the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline, which is opposed by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, through whose ancestral land it passes. The Labor Federation says the pipeline will create jobs for their members, while ignoring the fact that moving 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day will have a devastating impact on the climate. Meanwhile, a majority of 1,200 delegates of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, who gathered in Chicago for their convention in early September, voted in favor of a resolution to make the fight against climate change a priority for the foreseeable future. The person who initiated the resolution was John Harity, president of the Connecticut State Council of Machinists since 2011. Harity, who has been a member of the union for 37 years and works at Pratt & Whitney, first won support for his resolution from members of his Connecticut local. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with John Harity, who says he was inspired to become active on climate change issues after reading a 2012 article in Rolling Stone magazine written by environmentalist Bill McKibben. The article, titled Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, explained that we must leave 80% of fossil fuels in the ground if humans hope to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius, which was until recently considered the tipping point of runaway climate chaos. However, more up-to-date research shows that the tipping point is more likely 1.5 degrees. Here, Harity tells the story of how delegates were moved to support his resolution, and how the Machinist Union adoption of an activist position on global warming could influence the rest of the U.S. labor movement.
The issue was that we have thousands of members who work in fossil fuel-related industries, and in particular on the railroads hauling coal that goes from Appalachia basically to the West Coast in order to be put on ships to be sent to China. And those workers are understandably concerned about their future and about their jobs, and they're more likely to be against anything that talks about climate change than they are to be supportive of it. So when the resolution came up, the committee that reviews resolutions recommended that the convention not pass the resolution because of the fears from the fossil fuel folks. And under discussion, delegates get up and speak pro or con on what's before them. And there were six mics, and people at all six mics said that they were opposed to the resolution and hoped it got voted down. But before debate is closed, the president of the union, who's chairing the meeting, always asks, is there anyone speaking in opposition? So I was. My opposition was that they should pass the resolution. And so I spoke to the delegates, and I basically told them our kids and our grandkids were counting on us to deal with this issue, and that it was coming regardless of whether we did a resolution or not. And then I finished up, and there was a voice vote. The chair was uncertain which way the voice vote went, so there was a standing vote of the delegates. I asked them before they voted to take out their cell phone and look at a picture of their kids or their grandkids, because those were the people that they were affecting by their vote on the resolution. What I'm told is that that was effective in getting people to think about it. The vote was 503 against the resolution and 607 for the resolution, so the resolution passed. And it was a great moment, I think, for the union, because it put us in the position of moving forward and being in the leadership of this issue, which is where we need to be. So I think it was a great step for our union, and hopefully we'll get a number of other U.S. unions following suit, and we can address this more aggressively than we have.
John Harity, is there a labor group working nationally on this issue?
The group that I'm most aware of, which is also an excellent organization, is called the Labor Network for Sustainability. As much as climate change is a crisis, we think it also represents an opportunity to rebuild the U.S. economy on the basis of a renewable energy economy, which is a huge undertaking and should provide literally millions of jobs. Labor Network for Sustainability has been great in terms of encouraging folks like me to try and bring their unions around to understanding that climate change is something that the labor movement needs to be involved in.
That was John Harity, president of the Connecticut State Council of Machinists. Learn more about the labor movement's views on climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.